to CrimeWire, an elite team of veteran investigation experts, along with noted CrimeWire consultants and attorneys, often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crime to find answers and seek justice. The CrimeWire team, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, and Susan Murphy Milano, a violence expert and author, are there, on top of the crime, at the top of their game. CrimeWire is the place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in anytime during the show. The number is 646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room right here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or family member and would like to send the CrimeWire team information on an unsolved or suspicious death case, or want to be considered for a segment for a case on a future show, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. As you know, my friend and co-host Susan Murphy Milano has been diagnosed with stage 4 cancer and will be off for the next several weeks while she undergoes treatment. You can show your support for Susan and keep up with her progress by visiting her site at www.conqueringcancer.me. On Saturday morning, April 21st, 2012, Sergio Celis called police in Tucson, Arizona to report that his six-year-old daughter, Isabel, had vanished from her bedroom overnight. 4 months later, Isabel remains missing. Sergio and his wife, Rebecca, remained silent in the beginning of the investigation, but later agreed to speak out to the media about their daughter's disappearance. Much can be gleaned from their statements to the press. Blood evidence was found in the Celis house, and Sergio had been restricted from seeing his other children and family. But as of now, no arrests have been made, and Isabel's whereabouts remain unknown. Although there are many theories floating around regarding possible human trafficking, sexual assault, and speculation as to whom the kidnappers could be, there seems to be nothing in the way of concrete evidence to lead authorities to the answers they need. Joining me tonight to discuss what happened to Isabel Celis is CrimeWire consultant, statement analyst Peter Hyatt. Peter, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Denny. Thanks for having me on.
And Peter, I understand that there's some breaking news in another case I'd like to have you touch on before we start talking about Isabel. And this is, I believe, the Charlie Rogers case that you profiled last week?
Yes, and it was an interesting show last week. We had talked about a report of a horrific hate crime that was alleged to have taken place in Lincoln, Nebraska, in which a 33-year-old woman had alleged that three men broke into her home, forcibly took her from her bed, handcuffed her with ties, beat her, subdued her, and then carved hateful slurs into her flesh, took gasoline, spread it around the house, lit it on fire, and spray-painted epithets on the basement wall. And she was able to escape with her life, crying naked, over to her neighbor's house. And the police called in the FBI to help investigate, because obviously there was a hate crime and there are some issues in the homosexual community that are becoming quite hot potatoes in that area just prior to this, regarding housing and some other issues, where the political climate was pretty combustible, to say the least. They did not release her name. I think that was part of the reason. The other reason would be is because these three masked men attempted to kill her. And in order to carve into someone's flesh, it's a very controlling and controlled sadistic thing to do. They'd have to be very dangerous killers, so Nazi-like killers, someone that enjoys that sort of thing. So they did not release her name. In the basement, it was written, "We have found you," with the slur, which indicates that she had been searched for. So they did not release her name, and they kept this down. And she had said to the newspapers, apparently, that she didn't like that some people questioned her story. I was unable, Denny, and along with the statement analyst readers, we were unable to find a single news article anywhere that questioned her story. Not one. All we found was one line that said, and police haven't ruled out the possibility that this didn't happen, or police have to investigate as a matter of course that it could be a hoax. But there were no interviews with anyone that indicated that anyone, any place, anywhere had questioned her story. But she decided to come out, and the purpose of the interview, this was stated by media, was she would speak to media and assert that she had told the truth and this really did happen to her. So what happened was she spoke for roughly just a little more than 5 minutes, I believe around 460 words she used, and I had done the analysis of her appearance where she gave her name. She was lauded as a heroine, as brave. They held fundraisers, candlelight vigils, protests. She was galvanizing her community. They began to send in donations. There were these no hate tattoos. People were getting their body permanently marked with a tattoo for her, and the tattoo artist was donating money to her. We were made to understand that she was unable to work because of the hate crime, and was both an employer and employee, according to various reports. And so literally, including the mayor there and politicians and many others, thousands upon thousands of people across the country rallied to her support. And Denny, there was not anywhere to be found anyone who questioned her story when I did the analysis. I mean, no one anywhere. And what I did was I simply, as you know, in statement analysis, we don't attempt to be neutral or to try to be to have no presuppositions. As a matter of fact, when we approach an interview, we come with the presupposition that the person is innocent and the person is telling the truth. The reason we do this is so that if we are hit with something that is unexpected and doesn't fit with the truth, we'll catch it. So if some people are very suspicious by nature and they go in and they see suspicion everywhere, in statement analysis, we go in already presupposing the person is innocent and the person has told us the truth. So what we did was we listened to, and I say we, Heather and I, and lots of readership that chipped in on the analysis, listened to the video. I transcribed it, and the analysis conclusion was that she was deceptive, that there was no linguistic connection between her words and what she reported to happen. And we don't know anything else about the crime. We know that no one anywhere is questioning it, and there's not a single publication anywhere that is at this point questioning her story or even raising doubts. So, of course, I submitted the analysis to law enforcement, and as it turned out, I not only had concluded that she was deceptive, but I concluded that she may have had someone's help, because a friend spoke to media, and the friend's language was extremely soft for such a horrific crime. We listened, and we expected to hear things like, I was telling the truth, I told the truth, and I was cut, and it hurt, and they attacked me, and they must be arrested, and people are afraid. We expected just those common responses that anyone would have. Instead, she painted herself as a heroine. One of the surprising things, I think, for listeners is that in that five-minute statement, I don't think she told a single lie. As much as deception is concluded from A to Z, she was deceptive. This did not happen. Sentence by sentence, every sentence is true. She said things like, people have an agenda. That's true. I feel like a pawn. That's true. There is fear. That's true. I'm not afraid. That's true. And sentence by sentence, except that none of it fit into the reality of what was alleged. And the FBI had it. Some of the local media had a copy of it. There was other analysis they had prior to this. But what happened at that point was that they began to and I got to tell you, I tip my hat to them. They began to take the analysis and compare it to the physical evidence. And this is where I tip my hat to law enforcement. I did not see this coming. I did not see an arrest coming in the case. What I had said, I think I said it last week on the broadcast, that I had believed that there was, because of the political hot potato, that law enforcement was going to just kind of drop the ball and say, we can't prove it happened, but we can't conclusively arrest her because we don't have eyewitnesses. In the 2004 case at the University of Nebraska, where an ethics teacher, ethics professor, had alleged the same thing, she was seen by two witnesses spray painting her own car. So she spent 2 years in federal prison. She got tagged for it. But here, they did a magnificent job. They did the courageous and right thing in spite of political pressure. They have tackled issues, I think, by not allowing the community to live in fear of three horrific, dangerous people. And they have released some of the information. The police chief spoke, and he gave a whole lot of information where he said he laid out that this was premeditated. They found that she had gone to the store several days before she reported it, and she purchased the zip ties. She purchased the knife. She denied purchasing the gloves, for instance, said they weren't mine, but yet her DNA and another female's DNA was found inside of them. The forensic doctor concluded from the University of Nebraska that the lines that she cut into her, they either were cut into by herself, very superficial, or someone cut into it for her, which is what I think may have happened in terms of what the analysis is suggesting, not indicating fully, but suggesting. She had alleged that they grabbed her on the bed and threw her down on the bed, and that's where there was no blood on the bed. And matter of fact, the bed sheet was not ruffled. There was no male DNA in the house anywhere. There was no sign of forced entry. She said that her I think she had three or four dogs, that the dogs were passive with the attackers, yet the dogs ganged up on the police when they came in. And so as her story, go ahead, Denny.
I was just chuckling. I couldn't help it.
The story just fell apart piece by piece this way. And so whether it was a forensic analysis, and the conclusion was self-inflicted or passively allowing someone to do so, that didn't happen. There was no blood on the bed. The bed sheet was undisturbed. No male DNA in the home, only female DNA. And I think we're going to find that out. There'll be another arrest perhaps. She also, this is interesting. And this concerns me as a citizen of the United States, is that we live in a climate today where people can be shouted down without being heard in the realm of political correctness. In every place where this case was discussed, any time a commentator said, you know, I don't think she's telling the truth, they would be shouted down with claims of homophobe and you're a hate monger and you're this and that. Well, we also learned that she had carved the symbol of a cross into herself, which would obviously lead investigators to believe that not only did these men do this, but these men represent Christianity. And so we see the hate of people of religion and the intolerance towards people of religion. I understand that for those who hold to 2,000 years of Christianity or 4,000 years of Judaism, that their belief system, which is based upon ancient scripture, doesn't allow for homosexuality. I get that. And I know that people can live in peace. They can agree to disagree. But the shouting down, especially of truth, and not allowing truth to be sold because someone's afraid they'll be accused of having hate if they doubt someone's story, this is highlighting for people, I think, the backlash of the lack of freedom of speech that we have in our country today. People are afraid to speak up. And I think this is the same thing among analysts, crime analysts. Denny, no one touched this story. It was amazing. I had written out for several weeks in a row, and a couple of people wrote in saying, you know, at this point it's overkill. No one else is talking about it. Why should we be afraid to talk about a crime when what we're all concerned about is the violence.
Yeah, you raise good points. Well, first of all, let me a couple of questions I had was she do you know what she's been charged with? Would be falsely reporting or what type of charge was filed?
At this point, it's false reporting, and I don't know if there are going to be federal charges to follow, because lying to law enforcement is a misdemeanor, but lying to federal law enforcement is a felony. That's what got the
yes, and you said the FBI was in on this case, right?
Exactly,
because of the hate crime aspect.
Yep.
As far as you know, Peter, from I realize this is breaking news, maybe all the details aren't available yet, but from what you've heard so far, was this primarily the local police that came to this conclusion, or was a joint effort? Was the FBI involved in the investigation that led to these to this charge that she's been arrested on?
We know that it was so far three agencies. One is the FBI, one is the Lincoln Police. There might be also, of course, the state police, but there was also the fire marshal's office was in on it too, the fire inspectors. Now, fire inspectors and fire investigators don't spend a lot of time in firearms practice, in firearms training, in vehicle training. So they oftentimes can be quite good at their jobs because they're specialized. They're specialists, whereas a particular law enforcement may have to spread out everything, all a bunch of different things, and interviewing is not always high up on the skill level. Well, for the fire inspectors, they are good at what they do, and they were able to determine that this was a very small amount of gasoline used. If someone wants to torch a house, gasoline is something pretty easy to light up. They noted that only $200 of damage was done in the home. Then the police also reported that the words, "We have found you," and then the slur, that was something that she didn't initially even report. One of the astute readers of the blog had mentioned in an open letter to Charlie Rogers was, if someone wanted to make a statement of hate against you, why would they even write it in the basement? Why not right across your forehead for everyone to see? Some people wondered, and finally, I think one body language analysis person came out, and not a strong analysis, even though it was a 5-minute sample. That's an awful lot. Watching someone who, Ben, if you've ever been cut by a knife, you know how painful that is. Even a slight cut, how long it takes to heal, how the healing comes in layers and itches. And here we're seeing a woman who appears to be very comfortable just a few days after having her flesh carved sitting up. And so I wondered about the body language people, where they were. And the silence has been quite loud, I think.
Yeah, well, you know, another interesting point or a point of concern for me, I believe, as well as you, is this political correctness business that where you have to be afraid in many cases to exercise your right to free speech because you're going to be branded as something bad. If you disagree with a person or a person's position on an issue or something and you question that person, suddenly you're going to be something, branded as something that's demeaning and is not a good thing. So you're right. People, I think, all too often tend to back off. They don't want to take the chance of picking up that label, and some things are allowed to kind of go unchallenged because of that fear. So, and whoever came up with this idea, I don't know where it originated. This, as soon as somebody says something, allege that they are this, that, and the other thing. It's a very successful, as near as I can tell, it's a very successful approach to the detriment of society, I believe, but it works.
Yeah, and in fact, I can offer you proof of that in general, and locally and in history. Locally, in this case, this type of dangerous, violent crime that was reported, this is really fighting stuff, and there's no one in their right mind in America that approves of this sort of violence, and you know, it's just horrific. That put people at risk in Lincoln, Nebraska. This should have been covered, Nancy Grace and the other shows. This should have been covered everywhere without fear of repercussion or fear of being called a hate monger or anything else. This was a crime that was reported, and a hate crime that was reported. Now what has actually taken place, which Charlie Rogers herself said, she said, this is a crime. And she's right. This is a hate crime that she's perpetrating against people of religion. So there was this reaction throughout the country where the shoutdowns of homophobe, which means if you disagree with me, you must be afraid of me, which is really kind of a crazy concept within itself. If someone doesn't agree with my behavior, that doesn't mean they hate me personally. They just don't agree with my behavior. That's or what I do or how I look or whatever. That's fine. We live in a pluralistic society, and we can get along with that. But when the arguments become changed and they become propaganda, this is where it gets dangerous. Here's the historical example. In 1939 in England, the British people did not believe the media reports about the Nazi persecution of the Jews, 1937, 1938, 1939. They did not believe any of these things, on the most part, because in the First World War, just 20 years prior, they had been given so much phony anti-German propaganda. The Germans are coming, they're going to eat your children, and they're barbarians, and they're cannibals. That was one of the things that the British had heard. And they found out that these things, they were lied to by their own media. So when the truth came out, it's the boy who cried wolf, and there were truthful things about barbaric practices by the Nazis against the Jews, many people in England did not believe them because of the propaganda. And the police chief himself addressed this same theory where he said, we don't want crime victims to be afraid to come forward because of what Miss Rogers has done. She has really done a disservice to all of us as Americans, because we all are united in the hatred of violent crime. No one considers this anything but what it is. So she has set that back, and I think this is the natural backlash of what happens in hypersensitivity. There's been studies to show that when, and I've been in them myself, where someone is forced into what's called a sensitivity training, and they're being told that their culture is inferior and the other person's culture is superior in every way, and it becomes a terrible Pinocchio snowball where they're being, you know, you are the bad guy and their other culture is the good guy. As they walk out the door, the bitterness is through the roof. We saw this in a training that I had to attend years ago where we were being told how to handle certain ethnic groups and how to behave. And the speakers were bragging about all the things that they had discovered, that their ethnic group had discovered in America, and it was everything. So I raised my hand, and I jokingly said, is it true that your people were the ones behind the rocket science that helped us land on the moon? And they looked at each other and said, oh, yes, it was one of our people. And I was joking. I was bluffing. And people around me kind of chuckled, but that's what the impact was. And they walked out feeling worse. So I think it's just a big mistake. Instead of allowing us to have legitimate differences and being free to express them without fear of repercussion, there's always a backlash to this sort of shout down and hatred. And so in the name of tolerance, they're being terribly intolerant. In the name of condemning hate, they're being hateful. So what we have, I think, and this is maybe something I love about statement analysis, getting to the truth, is just truth. That's all we want. We don't care what, to us it didn't matter what her sexuality was. To her it did, obviously. To us what mattered was, did her words match the description of what happened? Did her words reveal deception, or were they truthful? We saw this in different ways, in different cases. When someone goes missing, a child goes missing, people have said, well, you only care about white children. And then a black baby goes missing, and so we report on that. Whatever's covered in the media, we're able to look at those statements at the speed of sound. It's crazy. The moment someone speaks across the country, we know it everywhere, and within an hour, there's an analysis out there. So it's really quite an amazing thing. It, for us, it doesn't matter. When a child goes missing, no one's asking, well, what's the race of the child? The first thing they're saying is, what are the parents saying? What are the police saying? Has an Amber Alert been listed? People of goodwill, caring about others, caring about their neighbors, wanting to get to the truth. So I think that this case really has highlighted the growing rift in our country that's really picked up speed in the last few years, where we're afraid to speak and we shouldn't be. This is not how Americans were supposed to be.
I was just thinking that while you were talking, now as it stands now, you know, pending a federal charge being filed for lying to a federal investigator, but as it stands now, if nothing more happens, you're looking at a misdemeanor. As far as I know, this Charlie Rogers does not have a criminal record, so you probably wouldn't be looking at any jail time, maybe a probation or something. But what I would like to see, if she is found guilty or pleads guilty to the false reporting, would be that she'd be required to pay some restitution for the manpower and the time and expense that the police had to put in or did put in trying to find three phantom non-existent perpetrators. And, you know, the other thing, too, is I don't know how many officers were involved in the investigation or anything, but probably there are some actual crime victims out there who may not have gotten adequate service or had maybe some effort was taken off their case to chase these three alleged attackers. So I would like to see her held as accountable as possible if she is found or to be guilty or pleads guilty. I hope she just doesn't get a reprimand and walk out of court.
Yeah, I don't think she will. When I read the affidavit and when I listened to the police chief this evening, he said that Charlie Rogers spread fear in our area. And then he said she has cost us a great deal in resources. So I think that's part of it. I know that when – this was interesting. We talked about this on the last show, that it was at the University of Nebraska where the former ethics professor had done a similar thing where she had the fake hate crime as well. Denny, she ended up being convicted of lying to the FBI when she reported a hate crime. She, I think, spent almost 2 years in prison for that. So, and there's also the point of fines, where someone is going to face fines because, remember the resources spent on the balloon boy, that hoax? How about the untold tens of thousands of dollars that Casey Anthony's lies and Cindy Anthony's lies cost law enforcement, taxpayers, and Tim Miller and EquiSearch? Texas EquiSearch. So the cost of deception is extreme for all of us. The case of missing 7-year-old Kyron Hallman out on the West Coast, that in Oregon, that was practically bankrupting that town. So, it pulls away resources. Vinny, we had a triple homicide here last week here in Maine, and a report of a rape just yesterday had to get pushed back because there weren't available detectives to get involved because they were on the triple homicide. So, these things do happen where things get pushed aside. So is it possible that victims, legitimate victims, could not get timely help because of this? Yeah, it's very possible.
Cam, you did the show with Peter last week.
Yeah.
But do you have anything about the arrest?
Yeah, well, what I have right here is just some questions from some folks in the chat room. They're just bringing up such great points that it's hard to keep up with them all. But one question for Peter from Hobnob is, does Peter think she will self-harm now that she has been charged?
Great question. I think that's an insight into her words. We all reveal ourselves when we speak. I'm not sure if anyone has read the book Wherever I Wind Up by R.A. Dickey, the pitcher for the New York Mets, wrote a book about child abuse. And he had been sexually abused as a child, and he is now 37 years old, and he's just come to terms with it and the trauma and the impact of it. Well, in his autobiography, he reveals quite a lot. Through the lens of statement analysis, he reveals a lot more than he perhaps realizes. Well, Charlie Rogers did the same thing. And readership, at one point when the story first broke, I think it was something like 92% thought it was fraudulent. And then by the end of the analysis, 98% of readership said it was fraudulent. They noticed a lot of the language was focused upon herself. And to answer the question plainly, yes, I do think there's a real risk of her harming herself. There seems to be a terrible self-loathing there for her, and a terrible need of attention. Her Facebook writing was interesting. She was, I guess, clever enough, or the mindset enough, that the night before and the night that this allegedly was to happen, she deleted all of her text messaging. So she got that down. But the actual, she put a Facebook message up for herself on her Facebook, I think it was on July 18th, so a couple of days beforehand, where she said to people, "Watch me. Watch what I'm going to do. Keep an eye on me." With a quote about how the people that others think are crazy are the ones that change the world. Well, she, actually the police chief was reading the quote, and media asked him to slow down and read it again. But this is what she said. "So maybe I am too idealistic, but I believe way deep inside me that we can make things better for everyone. I will be a catalyst. I will do what it takes. I will. Watch me." So obviously there's somebody that really has a need to feel valued, feel worthy, feel consequential. And she took it to extremes. So her question actually is really insightful. I think that, yeah, she's someone that's prone to self-loathing and could harm herself.
Right.
I want to see justice, as Denny said, and I want compassion and help for her after that. But, yeah, she should have to pay for this. It has to be a deterrent to others. The professor who would have known her, because she was a basketball star. She was a Husky, Nebraska Husky basketball star at the University of Nebraska where this professor was. The professor was a professor of ethics, spent 2 years in prison, and while in prison was writing papers on ethics. So I'm not sure that she learned her lesson. I think not. But I think that there must be justice. There must be she deserves prison time. And I would like to see some mechanism where she is made to pay back the money that was wasted. Her attorney never released the money from all the donations that they had. And that was kind of a signal that the attorney knew.
And that's another question that we've had in the chat room. Let me tell you, we got some smart gals, some smart folks in this chat room, and they are right on top of this. It's amazing.
Peter, before Kim asks any more questions, I just was thinking of another thing here about possible charges. You said that there may be some indications that Ms. Rogers had an accomplice to help her set this all up. If that can be proved, then wouldn't there likely be another charge for conspiracy? Now you'd have two people conspiring to commit a crime, even though it's only a misdemeanor, it's still a crime. So I'm wondering if there is another person involved, it might make the cheese a little bit more binding in the fact there'd be another charge or so that could be filed.
I think there will be. I think that those text messages likely shared into the plans. In the beginning, she was not willing to, or maybe the police weren't willing to release her name. she couldn't be a catalyst until she got out there and got things going. Well, she apparently had a friend speak for her. And what we listened for with her friend, and I just kind of ask you the same sort of thing, is if you had a close friend who was a victim of a hate crime and was terribly mutilated and cut, that sort of thing in front of you, what would you say? You would probably say things like, I want those bastards caught. What kind of animals could do this to my friend? Do you know how wonderful she is? Do you know what a sweet person she is? The people are in danger. We need these SOBs caught. We expect to hear an anger. Instead, her friend said that not that her flesh was cut into, she said her body was carved on. Carved on her body. Not carved in, carved on. So I thought, And then her friend said, we've got to deal with hate. We have to teach people. And I said, I heard the pronoun we, and I heard the idea of teaching, and I didn't hear any anger over this at all. I shuffled the analysis off to the police and said, I think you ought to consider that she may have had an accomplice. One of the astute readers, one of the astute readers pointed out, hey, Peter, in a chess game where she feels she's a pawn, there's other pieces involved, and which is an excellent point. So I do think she was involved with someone else, perhaps, and that could escalate charges, including conspiracy. So that's a great point, Denny.
It is. Excellent. It is a good point. And I just want to say that one of our guests also wrote, I thought self-inflicted, giving where it was on her body, and I wonder if it was written left to right and face up to her or upside down to anyone looking at her face on her, looking at her face on. So yeah, the point of how it was written and if she had an accomplice is definitely there. And just one more thing before I know we have to move on to this other case. It's so important. But one of our listeners, I just need to find it here. It was a great quote with Judge Judy. I think it was Equinox. The distinguished Judge Judy always says that if you tell the truth, you don't have to have such a good memory.
Interesting. Her, her attorney, I think this is a different attorney than she had handling the money, but this attorney said,
right.
But her story's never changed. And one of the things that people often fall for when it comes to deception is rote memory, is someone repeats things like a robot. When our memory's in play, we have the basic facts correct and they don't change. However, we remember more as we go on. At times when we repeat it, we don't use every detail because different things are important to us at different times. So the slight variations are not, they're the expected. We're humans, we do that. When someone is way off base and their story is constantly changing, a la Misty Croslin, that's a problem for deception. But when someone is just rotely repeating, what we often hear is what we call self-references, where they'll say, you know, like I said before, and as I said, or as I told the police earlier, they're working from memory, but not experiential memory. They're working from a script of what they said previously. That's why people will say that, because they're reminding themselves. So the fact that her attorney points out that her story hasn't changed doesn't make her story true. Kind of a goofy thing. The other thing about her friend is, and I've said this before and I mentioned this last week, the pronouns don't lie. We are, we've been using the pronoun my, for instance, since before we could speak. And if you think of anything that a human being does millions and millions and millions of times, you will know that the human being is good at it. So if I, this is kind of a test we give, and both of you can in your mind right now, I'd like you to think of something that happened to you 10 years ago or more. And I'd like you to picture it and just hold it in your mind, an event, anything that you want to think about. As you now recall that event, whatever it may be, do you recall if you were alone or with others at that event? And you can say, oh, I remember being at a at a baseball game and I was with others, or I was at a wedding and I was with others, or I was alone and I was afraid, or whatever the thing is, you likely won't mix up the word we and the word I. Even if it was 20 years ago, you'll still remember whether you were alone or with someone else. The pronoun I, by we as humans, is used over and over and over. It's the most used word in the English language. It's not one we're going to mess up. The pronoun we is the plural. It's not likely that you're alone that you're going to say we. If you've got all your marbles, you won't say we when you were alone. When someone does say we, it usually indicates cooperation, unity. I went to the store with so-and-so, or we went to the store. There's a difference in the two sentences. When her friend used the word we in the teaching, that was the linguistic indication from just a very small sentence that Charlie Rogers likely did not act alone. And that's probably who they're going to find the other female DNA in those gloves, and probably the text messages when they get retrieved that they haven't already will likely indicate it. They did a really thorough job on this. Oh, by the way, with the line someone said about the cutting, good observation. The forensic doctor said that the lines were too perfect. They were too straight. If there had been a struggle, they would not have been able to make these straight lines. They're also very superficial. They're very light. When someone wants to send a message of hatred and mutilation, oftentimes in a personal message like that, they target the face. We've seen those. There was a crime like that in New York City years ago where a model's face was carved up. That type of hatred is towards the face. We communicate with the face. This is why I've always taught that discipline never takes place in the face. The face is not for slapping or insulting because it's personal. In child raising, it's very personal. We communicate with that face. In this type of personal attack, they not only did they write in the basement, but they did not attack her face, where everywhere she'd go, she'd send this message of whatever the political message she said was going to be. So the lines were done very straight, very gently into her. My guess would be that there was probably some use of painkillers or something like that was done at that time. This hoax was carefully staged out, but still there were too many things that were left undone. Even if everything had been done perfectly, even if they had not blown the thing with the gloves or maybe made the lines more jagged, or if they covered all the tracks that way, no matter what anyone says, when the human being talks, they reveal themselves. When she spoke, she revealed herself. Lying causes internal stress. They avoid it. And this is how she gave herself away. So even if the other evidence hadn't fit, I still would have said, nope, that didn't happen. There's no connection there.
Okay, we're going to have to get on to Isabel, but this has been fascinating, and I'm sure that by next week maybe there'll be some more developments in this case, and we'll certainly do an update if there's anything new to report. Now, you know, there are a lot of things that trigger emotions in people regarding crime, and one of the main ones is when the victim is a child. That, if there's a homicide of an adult, that's bad. If there's a homicide of a child, it puts you through the roof. And this next case, it's not a homicide at this point, it's a teen person's case, but it involves a six-year-old, and it's very disturbing. Peter, why don't you, expand on the background I gave and tell us your thoughts on what may have happened to Isabel.
Sure. As a matter of fact, Denny, I think that the listeners will be interested to hear that the parents of missing six-year-old Isabel Chellis, the parents have given us a great deal of information to go on. They've given us a lot of guidance if we wish to know what happened to Isabel. But just for those who don't know, to back up the story, several months ago, Isabel Chellis, 6 years old, was reported missing from her home in Arizona. We didn't know anything beyond that, and people wanted to know why was there was there not an Amber Alert issued? When was an Amber Alert issued? Why wasn't it issued? That sort of thing. There was a lot of guessing in the dark. We knew, we saw her picture. They said that she was missing. She had been at a Little League game that evening, went to bed. Next morning, she was gone. The first thing that I think that crime followers and really, as you pointed out, Vinny, people that just really love kids and hate to hear this stuff, the first thing that people waited for was the natural reaction of a parent of a missing child. If you're holding your child's hand and you're in the supermarket and you let go of the child's hand, the child runs off, the first thing a parent does is call out for the child. It's the most natural reflex. If you're camping in the woods or on the beach or something and your child wanders off, the parent will yell for the child. These parents didn't. And as those first critical 24 hours came and went, we who were watching the case said, where are the parents? Why aren't they crying out in that natural reaction to Isabel? And if Isabel has been abducted, which is what it seems like they're reporting, we didn't know at the time, why aren't they getting on television and talking about Isabel and saying to the abductors, what do you want? We'll give you whatever you want. Just take care of Isabel. Use her name. Personalize her. We've seen it portrayed in Hollywood. Day two came by, nothing. Day three came by, nothing. Day four came by. After 4 days, they finally reluctantly took to the microphones, claiming that the police had told them not to. And when they opened their mouths, we knew there was a problem. Well, I have to back that up. We knew there was a problem before by their silence. It just goes against nature. It's just unnatural for a parent to remain silent while a child is missing. So they spoke out, and immediately there was a backlash. I had posted the analysis. People knew instinctively that something was wrong. And so what they said was that their child had been kidnapped, abducted. We did not yet have the 911 call. We did not have the information that we have now. So we're still at the point where, okay, let's give them the benefit of the doubt. I don't know why they didn't speak out, but it isn't right. But the father then went on television, and he was asked on television if he had anything to do with the disappearance of his daughter. And this is where I think everything began to fall apart. Around the same time, we learned that the police did not tell them not to speak. The police, in fact, urged them to speak, offering to facilitate the microphones and the media outlet and get everything set up outside their home. They were the ones, police said, who showed no urgency. Then police released that 911 call, and that was where, wow, this was not only deceptive, but it was deceptive for people with no training. In our training for 911 calls, particularly of domestic homicides, we look for certain signals that will tell us a person is a guilty caller. And probably people would be surprised to learn how many people who kill in their own home are the ones who pick up the phone and dial 911. We ask things like, does the call start with a greeting? And the reason we ask that is because when someone is missing, a child is missing, parents generally won't say, hello, how is the weather there? It's nice here. Things are well, except my daughter is missing. So if someone starts with a greeting, we don't say, okay, they're a guilty caller. We say, check red flag. This is a little concerning. Maybe they're just really nervous, give them the benefit of the doubt, but it is, yeah, it's a red flag.
That's what I thought.
Yep. And then we listen for the priority. We listen to what they say. If their priority is, I was sleeping, I was watching a ball game, I fell asleep, and it takes them several sentences to get to what's going on, then we also have another red flag. We saw this in the Patsy Ramsey 911 call of JonBenet. I think it took her four or five points to make, which were all to help her alibi, before she actually got to the point where her daughter was missing. And the 911 operator was surprised by this and came back and asked questions because of it. You ask yourself, what is the first thing you would say to a 911 operator if your child was missing? It would be, my child is missing. Well, you notice with Sergio, the father that made the phone call, not only was he deceptive, he said, we have an abduction. And I said, why do you think you have an abduction? He said, I don't know. He began to chuckle on the 911 call. I told my wife that you better get your butt home. Ha, ha, ha. And, of course, you can run and say, well, that's just nervousness. What you have to do to dismiss the 911 call is dismiss all the red flags, which were probably 18 or 20 points within that one call that showed this is a guilty caller. When they spoke, they referenced Isabel in the past tense. Generally speaking, a parent who has no guilty knowledge or no reason to believe the child is dead will not speak of the child as if dead in the past tense. Remember baby Lisa, the mother, said, we're only talking to the national media, not local media. Well, why not? Because we're grieving. Okay. What are you grieving? She referenced baby Lisa in the past tense. The cadaver dogs confirmed that baby Lisa was dead. Well, in this case, we have a similar type thing where Isabel was referenced in the past tense. Both parents have been deceptive. Both parents have had no urgency. In the 911 call, it is an alibi-building type of call, a type of setup. But then Sergio was confronted on a television interview, and he was asked, what do you say that people think that you're involved? And at this point, people did think he was involved with her disappearance. Police had gotten, with Child Protective Services, State Child Protective Services, a working agreement by which Sergio was removed from the house and had no contact with his wife or his sons. There was some confusion whether there was she was a stepmom or not, but he was to have no contact. Even sex offenders get supervised visitation. He has no contact at all, and he's agreed to this. What that means is that Child Protective Services was able to go to him with the police and say, this is the information we have that shows that you pose a state of jeopardy to your children, to your sons. If you stay away from them, we won't file guardianship to take away your guardianship at this time. Will you agree? He agreed to stay away. So we have now a deceptive 911 call. We have a standing order through the Child and Family Services or Child Protective Services of no contact with his kids. Then he goes on television and he is asked, what do you say to it? So what we ask listeners to do is to pretend that they are Sergio, pretend that they have nothing to do with it, presume him innocent, presume that he's got no guilty knowledge of it. And what would you say if you were accused of kidnapping or killing your own daughter? So we wait for him to say, I didn't do it. I didn't have anything involved with it, and I didn't harm her. I didn't do any of those things. So he was asked, what do you say to this? He was asked, he said, you know, there's no easy way to ask this question, but because this is your first live television interview, Sergio, use his name, let me ask you this question. What do you say about questions about whether you had anything to do with your daughter's disappearance? Now listen to Sergio's answer. Gosh, I wish I knew where to begin. We are so frustrated to try to understand why this is happening and why this had to happen, why Isabel had to be targeted. We just don't understand that. And to whomever did this, please, look at her. Look at her. She's beautiful. She doesn't deserve this. She deserves to be home. She deserves to be home in her room playing with her brothers and just loving life the way she does. There are so many things that are just so frustrating and so difficult to deal with. So the first thing we notice when asked about if he had any involvement is that he does not deny having involvement. Our statement analysis principle, which is legally sound, we say if a person cannot bring himself to say he didn't do it, we are not allowed to say it for him. So if Sergio can't say in a live interview he didn't do it, we're certainly not going to say it for him. We saw how he stalled. He avoided answering the question, making that question sensitive to him. And then he focused in on her looks, and that was concerning to me, focusing in upon the little girl's looks. Because in other statements he's made, Denny, there's linguistic connections between what he said and the language of those who sexually abuse children. Language similar to what John Ramsey used, for instance. JonBenet Ramsey, 8'6", had a history of urinary tract infections, so much so that it was screaming off the charts, sex abuse, constant bedwetting, constant bednessing, dressing up like a little Las Vegas showgirl, a sexualized nature, all those things point to it. But his language itself gave us linguistic indications that this is an area that we would explore. Well, it's the same thing with Sergio. He's focusing upon, instead of saying, I didn't do it, he's saying, she's so beautiful. We don't know why she had to be targeted. He also jumped from I to we. He was asked specifically, in fact, the interviewer did an excellent job in the sense that he used Sergio's name in the question, really bringing him into focus. Sergio, you're the one people are saying you had something to do with it. Well, golly gee, Josh, I don't know what we're going to think about this. He couldn't bring himself to answer.
Red flags?
After red flag, after red flag.
Peter, we're rapidly running out of time here. We're going to have to shut down in a minute or so. So why don't you take us to a place that will be convenient to break that we can get to in a minute, and then we'll pick up from that point next week.
Okay.
So can you think of a good anything else you want to cover, and then we'll stop and we'll resume from that point next week.
Sure. In the investigation, law enforcement appears to have focused and narrowed in upon the family. I think that they know that the parents are lying, that the parents are involved, but they can't do much, at least as far as I understand, with the little evidence they have. They have two lying parents and they have blood. It seems like a lot. Denny, I know that you're old school, and I agree with you. I think there should have been arrests and that someone might have spoken and talked while under arrest, just like in the Joshua Powell thing.
Let me ask this. If this is a kidnapping or an alleged kidnapping, are the feds involved here?
Yes. The FBI came out early in the case. I had no contact with them, so I don't have any firsthand knowledge. I believe, however, that it was, from the federal point of view, closed, saying, you guys know who did it. You're going to have to figure out a way to prove it with the family. They're not out looking for kidnappers. The information they have on the father apparently is really bad.
Okay. Let's break right there, Peter. Because we really don't have time to get into anything further on this, and we'll pick it up right here next week. Thanks to the Crime Wire team, our Director of Research, Kim Colton, and Public Relations team at ImaginePublicity.com. Our next show will be on Tuesday, August 28th, when my co-host will again be Crime Wire Consultant Statement Analyst Peter Hyatt. Remember, we ensure that your voices will be heard when there is nowhere else to turn. Visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com. God bless from the Crime Wire team, Denny Griffin and Susan Murphy Milano. Thank you and good night. Thanks again, Peter, and we'll be talking with you next week.
Good night. Thank you.
Okay, good night, everybody. Good night, Kim.
Good night, Denny. Good night, Peter.